This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
I spent $40,000 on shoes?
What's the matter, Morty?
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another episode of the Every Outfit Podcast. Chelsea, I'm very excited that we have pop culture and fashion news to talk about because it really was like under the wire of like, do we need to do a mailbag episode or is there going to be enough stuff to talk about?
I know. Thank God the pop culture gods came through. And for that, I am so grateful. But I want to know how you're doing. You're looking a little tired. You've been hard at work in the Every Outfit Couture Fulfillment Center.
AKA my living room. Yes. We launched some merch. Some would say finally.
Well, I would say finally, because we've been working on this for a really, really long time.
It turns out if you're trying to launch merch that you fulfill yourselves, that you also pick up from the place that makes it, while also going on tour, while also moving, things can get a little hectic. Who knew?
A fuck at hat or two can get lost in the shuffle, is what you're saying. But thank you to everyone that bought stuff. We are very excited about this drop. And we basically started from scratch. Like, we vastly improved the quality of what we've been selling. And we don't outsource our merch to those, like, sad Zazzle-esque print-on-demand websites like other podcasters.
Here at Every Outfit, we're control freaks. To the point where our manager is like, can you just hire someone else to do it? And we're like, no. Because here's also the thing. The easiest thing to automate would be doing the merch or at least having it fulfilled somewhere else. But as people who are perma freelancers, now podcasters, it's the only tangible physical thing we are able to do in our jobs.
Well, it's also just so satisfying for me having an idea for something, getting it made, and then putting it in a box. Like, it's the full circle. I guess seeing someone wearing it would be the end of the circle, but the circle of life.
Please send us photos of you guys in the merch. And if you got the wrong item, then you're gonna have to blame me because I was watching Owning Manhattan in the background while I was fulfilling orders.
I got like halfway through one episode of that show and then got very depressed.
It is wild watching real estate agents justify their existence in the year 2024 because I understand their need when our parents were buying homes, but thanks to the advent of the internet, you really don't need a real estate agent to find property. In the era of Redfin and Trulia. And so, as someone that has watched the entire season of this, it is just people being like, well, why should we hire your firm against all these other firms? And they're like, don't you know that Ryan Serhan has 2 million TikTok followers? Like, he is able to harness the power of social media to sell your home.
What, to one of the 3,000 billionaires that can afford that one apartment in Manhattan in the first episode?
Oh, the $250 million apartment? Yeah.
Like, I don't really think that TikTok factors in there.
All TikTok and YouTube is doing is fueling millennials like us that cannot afford $10 million, $20 million, $250 million homes. films, but are like, I'm not going to watch The Bear season 3, but I will watch this 12-minute tour of an insane apartment in Manhattan. But the lack of conversion from TikTok Chell to actually buying a very expensive home, you see almost every episode of Owning Manhattan. It'll be like Ryan Seacrest calling a client being like, I got great news. They're coming in at 11-2. And then the seller's like, okay, but you literally said to my face, you promised me you'd get 11-8? And so I'm not going to accept this offer. And I guess his power is just convincing people to sell their homes for less than he said he would.
It all seems very shady to me.
Anyway, what was your favorite piece of merch that you designed?
I mean, I did the concepts for everything, but design-wise, it's like I designed some stuff, Paul designed some stuff, Stephen Smith, who did our logo, designed some stuff. So it was a real family affair. Tat did some unpaid consulting work.
That's true.
We had to make sure that that t-shirt shape was correct.
Guys, you have no idea. It was like a month of sourcing different blanks to find the perfect t-shirt.
Absolutely, because as someone that buys a lot of merch, I am so sick of like buying something I love and then realizing like, oh, it actually can't withstand more than a few goes in the washing machine. Like shit does not hold its shape. The way that t-shirts and hoodies are constructed now is like a literal epidemic. Like, you know that Lil' Kim song where she's like, under 7 inches? Sorry. That's how I feel about cotton. It's like, if it is less than 6 ounces, hard pass.
That's right. And we've moved past tote bags, right? We all have too many tote bags.
Yeah, I don't want to do totes unless we can find one that actually can have a long, fruitful life and not just become one of those gross tote bags that you fill with other gross tote bags. Like, a tote bag only actually looks good like for 3 days if you're actually using it for something practical.
That's true. I also keep for the Every Outfit archives one of every piece of merch we've ever designed, and I think our original tote bags are deteriorating somewhere in a Tupperware in storage.
I'm sure they are, but it's hard to say my favorite piece. I mean, I think the Fashion Victims Unit stuff is so funny. That is something we've been wanting to do forever.
I encourage people to buy these pieces of merch because we're definitely at some point going to get a cease and desist from Dick Wolf Productions. So get them while you can.
Don't put that out into the universe.
I put it in the universe so that it won't happen. Every time we've gotten a cease and desist, surprisingly, we've been shocked.
It's been a while since we've been hit with a cease and desist, and it's sad that we can't talk about them because we got one from a luxury brand that was so unhinged once. It was like literally like 10 pages about the heritage of the brand.
You couldn't find the cease and desist because, yes, you're right. The first 10 pages was literally a Wikipedia entry about the brand.
But yeah, fingers crossed, guys. Also, we have sew-in tags for the first time in our merch, which has been my dream, I suppose, since childhood, since I definitely wanted to be a fashion designer as a young girl.
They're not just sew-in tags that say Every Outfit Couture. I think what really makes them is that on the other side, it says fuckettes only.
God is in the details, you know?
We are also coming off of our last potentially U.S. show. We don't know. We're trying to add dates. We'll see if that happens. But we culminated our West Coast tour with not one, but two shows in Los Angeles.
Which were great. We love a hometown show. The venue was great.
We did it at the Bourbon Room. And initially, you were hesitant because you had seen photos of actual, like, wood barrels on stage. And you were like, I can't. We can't have those. It doesn't work with us.
Well, we performed at so many city wineries, though, and the oak barrels are, like, plentiful. I think it's just something we can't really escape. But no, there were no barrels in sight.
More fun was
the green room situation. That was major. It was so far down. It was like you had to go down 4 flights of stairs, like a long, like, scary, dark passageway. When the guy was leading me down there, I was like, at what point do I scream for help? You know, my phone went into SOS mode. I found a kidnapped woman in a pit with a dog named Precious down there.
At a certain point, you do enter the irreversible tunnel where you, like, to get to the green room, you literally leave the building and go down an alleyway.
That's exactly what it was.
Because it was a hometown show, so people we knew did come backstage. And instead of making them go down this harrowing, literal descent.
Yeah, it's like that film, The Descent. the scariest movie I've ever seen, for the record.
No, Chelsea, that's going to be Long Legs. At least that's what all of the tweets and press are telling me. It's like, I need Nicolas Cage to come out of the screen and murder me for how scary people are saying Long Legs is going to be.
Well, we're about to find out.
Anyway, so we had people come backstage instead, but the backstage was only like 2 feet. Like, literally, people would just come behind the curtains and we were literally there. No, what I loved about the Bourbon Room is there were so many entrances. It felt like you were on a film set.
Oh, it was like the set of a 70s sitcom. There was 3 different door options for how to come out onto the stage.
Usually at venues, we come in, we do a sound check. And because we've never played at the same venue twice over 2 days, we didn't do a sound check. We just plugged everything in. We're like, we did that yet last night. It'll be fine. And it was not fine. But no one knows the difference. No one knows
how non-awkward the beginning of the show could be.
Yeah, of course. They just assume like, okay, I guess the show starts with 3 attempts at the theme song with no volume. And then they play it through.
Oh, my God. Anyway, thank you to all the fuckettes that came out to those shows. It was so nice seeing you in our home city.
So much so that we did a photo shoot before, because we got to get good pics. And we actually saw a fuckette on the street as we were doing this photo shoot, which, is that embarrassing? Is it not embarrassing? It's embarrassing for us, mostly because someone was like, Lauren, Chelsea, and I turned around thinking it was one of our friends, but thankfully it was just a fuckhead who caught us doing a photo shoot on the streets.
I mean, I think doing any sort of photo shoot on Hollywood Boulevard is deeply dehumanizing, you know, for all parties involved.
The only nice thing is that you're surrounded by tourists who are very polite. Everyone just stopped so we could take the photos. We were like, oh no, you can walk through. Don't stop your vacation for us, please.
Anywho, shall we get into some And Just Like That news? It's been a minute since we've talked about And Just Like That.
The new guest stars or the fact that John Corbett doesn't like being an actor?
The fact that John Corbett doesn't like being an actor. We discovered because he went on a podcast hosted by Dana Carvey and David Spade. They have a podcast? What is this?
Oh, I'm sorry, Chelsea. Are you unfamiliar with the Fly on the Wall podcast?
Oh, God. Do you watch clips on YouTube or something? I bet you do.
It's definitely come up before. We discussed this at the beginning of the show, my fear of like, will there be enough pop culture stuff to talk about? But the alternative is forced to have other guests on, like a John Corbett, who then begins talking about how he doesn't want to be an actor.
Yeah, he says, quote, I'm in the fourth quarter of the football game now, in life and in showbiz. It's just a fact. So I can reveal now that I picked the wrong fucking thing to do with my life. I made a lot of money. I live in a beautiful home. Blah, blah, blah. But as far as fulfilling creative work life, I didn't write one fucking line. I didn't write one joke to make people laugh. So it's been unfulfilling on that level.
I'm of two minds about this because he goes on to talk about Emma Stone and Yorgos Lanthimos' creative relationship and how he would like to have the opportunity to do something like that. I understand that you didn't write one line, but like, do you write? Could you write?
Could you write Poor Things? Well, also, you can write. The thing about writing is that anyone can write,
whether it's good enough or not.
Being an actor is much harder because you can't just be an actor by yourself in your room. You need to be in a play or, you know, on a television show or creating content on YouTube or something.
Where I do agree with him is he relates being an actor and the waiting to the feeling of waiting in a doctor's office for an hour. And it's like, yeah, being an actor is very difficult, as you say, because you can't do it on your own. But like, being a working actor is boring in and of itself because you are on set for a long time, but your actual work is maybe like 45 minutes every 4 hours.
So what he's saying is he's just on his phone the whole time, and now he's depressed because of that.
The comedian Craig Ferguson, when he was on the Drew Carey show, had this same experience where he was like, holy shit, this is boring. You sit in your trailer all day. Do you know what he did? He fucking wrote screenplays that got made, Chelsea. My issue with this is it's not...
Yeah, babes, like, what's stopping you?
The way I first saw this story was like, oh man, I should have been a director, I should have been a writer. So I thought there was something like, I've written 7 screenplays that I can't get made, or I'm going to transition into directing. He's just more like, I don't know. This isn't very fulfilling. I wish I had a career like Emma Stone. It's like, yeah, me too, bitch.
Okay, he also is acting like acting isn't a creative job. Just because you are saying someone's words and working with a director doesn't mean that you're not doing anything creative. I just don't think he cares about acting.
He doesn't have to go back to his trailer for hours at a time. He could be part of the creative process by staying on set and learning what everyone does.
That's true. You know what? I appreciate John Corbett's candor here because I think this speaks to like a broader human experience. Like, a lot of people aren't fulfilled by their jobs. And sometimes when you get the thing that you want, it doesn't fill the void. Or as Courtney Love famously said, when I get what I want, I never want it again. And that's just a fact of life.
But I wonder if more and more actors are having this feeling, especially when they go on things like podcasts started by other actors or comedians or people in the entertainment industry, because podcasting has an immediacy. You don't have a boss. You don't have the barriers to entry that acting does. Like Dax Shepard, who hosts Armchair Expert, he interviews celebrities and then he interviews actual experts. And one of these experts was explaining to him that essentially this podcast to him, he took out all the things he hated about acting, the waiting, the being told what to do, and is doing everything he likes about acting, which is shooting the shit with people between scenes.
Good for him. He figured it out. Also, are you watching clips of that on YouTube also? Jesus Christ.
Comes up on TikTok. Don't worry about it. Now on to some new cast members who I'm sure don't find the acting experience to be unfulfilling. Although she was not officially announced, we did see a photo of the actress Jennifer Lewis photographed with Nicole Ari Parker. So it's safe to say LTW will be getting an additional supporting cast member.
If they actually don't spin this off into its own show, that's crazy, because the amount of characters that this one woman has at this point is absolutely insane.
This is the longest backdoor pilot possible. One of two things needs to happen. Carrie dies and LTW takes over the show, or yes, LTW moves to Los Angeles and we have an entirely different show.
Who is Jennifer Lewis going to be? She's someone that fascinates me because she's such a deeply eccentric person. She's on The View a lot, so I've seen her interviewed many times. And I actually just watched a very dramatic Robin Roberts sit down interview with her because she was on vacation in Africa and she fell off the balcony of her hotel and had to like learn to walk again and shit. But she only fell 10 feet into sand, which seems like it wouldn't be that bad. But anyway, clearly it was a near-death experience.
She's a woman of a certain age, okay? Their bones are brittle.
That's so fucked up, though, that you could fall 10 feet and have to learn to walk again. Anyway, God spared her only to cast her on And Just Like That.
In an unknown role. We also have Macaud Brooks, who, according to the auto-generated biography on Google, is known for his role as Matthew Applewhite in the second season of ABC's series Desperate Housewives.
Okay, that means nothing to me.
It also means nothing to me. The English actor Jonathan Cake has also been cast. Not sure who he is, but he, also from a Google search, I've learned he's married to the actress Julianne Nicholson, so that's cool.
Okay. Fab.
And then last but not least, Logan Marshall Green, who played Ryan Atwood's brother in The OC, as well as acting in films like Prometheus and Upgrade, as well as looking a lot like Tom Hardy. That's kind of what he's known for.
See, I don't understand anything you just said.
He was photographed with a beard, looking quite Tom Hardy-ish, leaving Carrie's Gramercy apartment, which could mean nothing.
He is dressed very hipster. I don't think anyone should look like this.
He's wearing a kind of threadbare vintage looking gray shirt that says dead weight.
But dead weight is misspelled.
Waiting.
What John Corbett's doing between takes.
Logan Marshall Green's look in these photos leaving Carrie's apartment, it feels like what the costume designers think Aidan Shaw now would dress like. Because he has like a little leather messenger bag. He's got faded jeans, a brown leather belt.
But it's like people don't even dress like this anymore.
It's very 2009.
It's giving period piece.
So he's photographed holding Carrie's cat, which maybe he found the cat, or it seems like Carrie's handing over the cat. Maybe she's like, I'm done with this.
Well, maybe she's just handing him the cat to give the cat to her. It is her cat, after all. Remember? She adopted Shu.
This is true. He's photographed leaving her apartment. There's also photos of Jonathan Cake having dinner with Sarah Jessica Parker. If we get back boyfriends of the week, I'll be happy. I'll shut the fuck up, Chelsea.
Yeah, sure. I'll take weird hipster dude from 2004 that finds Carrie's cat.
Just give me something.
Oh, and also Giuseppe promoted to series regular.
As well as Dolly Wells, who is the person that worked for the UN that Miranda had a flirtation with.
Shit, so maybe she's not going to get a girlfriend of the week then if they just shack up immediately.
Or are they just lesbian best friends? Maybe they hook up and are like, this isn't for us, but let's be lesbian besties.
Talk about something that needs more representation in media.
I also saw, Chelsea, that Hot Fellas is getting a brick and mortar location, to which I say, in this economy?
He is really popping off. I'm happy for him.
Take me back, Chelsea. So Hot Fellas started in a ghost kitchen and it was purely a delivery service. And so now they'll be open 9 to 5. People can come and get their Hot Fellas bread.
Except it looks more like a French bistro than an Italian bakery, although it looks very fancy. Like, I would definitely shop there if I bought loaves of bread ever.
I hope that this becomes the new brunch spot for the girls.
Oh, that would be cute.
Give Anthony that business. Come on.
So it's like Hooters meets Baltazar is what it looks like from the outside.
Honestly, this is deeply needed. Give women a place where they can get a latte and look at some abs at 9 a.m.
Okay, we have some other big news.
So it was announced that Disney is working on a sequel to The Devil Wears Prada. This was broken by Variety. They say that the storyline reportedly follows Miranda Priestly as she navigates her career amid the decline of traditional magazine publishing and faces off against Emily Blunt's character, now a high-powered executive for a luxury group with advertising dollars that Priestly desperately needs.
I actually kind of think this is a good premise. Yeah, I don't think we need to go full Anne Hathaway. I actually like the role reversal or the power reversal of this. And it also speaks to something that is true. It's like the magazine business has changed a lot since The Devil Wears Prada was written. Why not? I mean, we love Meryl Streep. I don't know if I want the same screenwriter, though. That's a little bit of alarm bells.
Well, I have bad news. The original screenwriter, Elaine Brosh McKenna, is set to come back. What I do find interesting, and we talked about this, we recently did a VIP episode about The Devil Wears Prada. The writer, the author of the book Devil Wears Prada, did write a sequel called When Life Gives You Lululemons, which is about the Emily character, but is a completely different plot. It's like Emily restarting her life in Connecticut or something. Entertainment Weekly is now reporting that Anne Hathaway, Stanley Tucci, and the original director are all in talks to return as well.
What about Patricia Field, though? Because that's the real question. That's what could make or break this situation.
Well, as we learned, as a fuckette reminded us, Patricia Field only designed the first season of costumes for Emily in Paris, so I think she is tech avail.
I hope she is, because this could get her her second Oscar nomination.
And hopefully first win.
Hopefully first win.
My concern about this plot is, while it is legit, is it interesting to anyone but us?
Fashion has never been more mass than it is at this moment.
No, but I mean the plot being about trying to get ad revenue dollars. We discussed this on our VIP episode. We love The Devil Wears Prada, but in this rewatch, we both realize there's not a lot of plot in The Devil Wears Prada.
No, we watched it again to discover that it's just montages and vibes.
Montages, vibes, and the iconic lines you remember kind of interspersed in between all of those things. So as long as they can do that.
Also, we should address the fact that the musical version of The Devil Wears Prada, starring Vanessa Williams, is premiering in London soon. And it's probably going to be fab because Elton John did the music.
And guys, we are still trying to work on a London date. Not so that we can see Vanessa Williams in this Devil Wears Prada musical, but not no.
But absolutely yes. Vanessa Williams is major. I saw her in a Broadway show a couple years ago and she was fabulous. So I would love to see her play Miranda Priestly.
I am also finding the rollout of these longed for sequels very interesting, because the Practical Magic sequel announcement was kind of similar to this, which is like unnamed sources are saying that this is happening instead of just an announcement of like, this movie's happening, here's everyone that's in it.
Yeah, I kind of prefer when they just do a hard launch, like when they hard launched the Hocus Pocus sequel and everyone was suddenly like, we're doing this.
Yeah, give me a still from the first day of set.
Send some assets to my social media manager and we will all post them simultaneously.
Lovely fuckette Heather Taylor texted me and was like, can you believe this news? It's so major. Remember when Meryl Streep said she wouldn't do a sequel because she didn't want to get skinny again? And I said, well, that's before Ozempic, so... thank you, Semiglutide, for clearing the way.
Has Meryl Streep's weight ever fluctuated more than 20 pounds in her entire fucking life?
Absolutely not. Do we think the wig will be the same?
For sure. We gotta keep the wig. That's also the Anna continuity. Not changing your hair is like a mark of a fashion icon.
And I know I've seen some people not be hyped on the fact that they don't like the idea of Miranda Priestly in her flop era, but that's good drama that the person that was under Miranda is now in the powerful position.
Also, in other women of a certain age news, Glenn Close and Halle Berry have been cast in the new Ryan Murphy legal drama All's Fair, starring Kim Kardashian. Wow, that's a sentence I never thought I would utter in my life.
When I first read this headline, I went, Glenn's never getting that Oscar now.
This just makes me even more hyped for this show. This makes me realize they're not fucking around.
They're not fucking around. And I also saw a title card for the show that said All's Fair, a new drama series from Ryan Murphy. And I was like, hold on, this is a drama? Ryan Murphy is his own genre in and of itself that somehow mixes drama, camp, and humor all together. But I guess I was imagining, not that I've seen Ally McBeal in 25 years, but it having the tone of whatever that was.
Same. I was thinking it would be kind of Ally McBeal meets Dynasty or Empire or another nighttime soap opera.
A Ryan Murphy drama, a tad different. I think it will be a nighttime streamer soap opera.
Yeah, I really hope it's episodic and we just get a different case every single week.
A procedural? Love it.
I hope so.
What the fuck was the pitch to get these two women in that show?
Yes, these are actors of a very high caliber, but it doesn't mean that they won't do something like completely crazy. Like, remember that Kathy Bates, Jessica Lange, Angela Bassett, all in American Horror Story Coven. And that was the craziest shit ever, you know, that wasn't necessarily highbrow per se. So I don't think that just because they've been cast, we should expect this to be like Succession or something.
The other surprising thing of Glenn Close being cast is she was also on a prestige FX legal drama called Damages for many, many years.
Right. I forgot about that. Well, I'm hyped. I'm more hyped than ever.
Look, they're making sure that Kim Kardashian can't fail by surrounding her with really great actresses. I'm sure she will bring, at the very least, her A-minus game. That's all she's got to do.
Yeah, absolutely. In other news, did Julia Fox come out of the closet on TikTok? You decide, guys. I guess we should just play the clip.
I love when I see a lesbian with their boyfriend. It's like, ah, you hate that man.
Hey, that was me. I was not lesbian. So sorry, boys. Won't happen again.
I don't know if I'm even qualified to have commentary on this. I would love to know your feelings, Chelsea.
What, are you afraid you're going to say something that's going to offend me? No, what do you actually think?
I mean, I found her choice to be asexual far more interesting. I mean, the like hating men to lesbian pipeline, I feel like, is a little tired.
Well, you can be gay and asexual, kind of like Tim Gunn.
I guess maybe I'm reading too much into this, but it sort of feels, based on other things that Julia Fox has said about men, of like, men are so annoying, women are just easier to deal with, so I'll just fuck them instead. As like a consolation prize.
But are women easier to deal with? Because having read her book, she has the most emotionally intense relationships with women that aren't necessarily sexual, but it seems like women have been the loves of her life in many ways.
Yes, and her greatest betrayers as well. Maybe she doesn't want to venture into lesbianism. Again, I think asexuality, it was working for her.
Look, I hope she's a lesbian. That would delight me to no end. But I've said this before and I've said it again. I do think that we need to normalize showing receipts. I feel strongly about this. That said, Julia Fox is clearly a member of the queer community of some kind. Her domestic existence is very queer. She bought a house with her best friend, Richie Shazam, who's a trans woman and lives there with her and her boyfriend. And they all raise her little baby. It's very Three Men and a Baby.
Honestly, give me that show or movie.
She's also just like kind of more like a gay man, personality wise, culturally.
Maybe she does have the sexuality of Tim Gunn.
I don't know where Julia Fox is in the rainbow flag exactly, but she's clearly there. So I'm looking forward to see how this develops for her. I think it would be really cool if she had a just like very butch girlfriend.
Well, you always think that.
I don't always think that, but I think maybe because she's so over the top femmy, she is like high femme. If she was a lesbian, she would be a high femme lesbian.
We should send her the J'adore Dykes baby tea.
Oh, we absolutely should. Guys, we will be restocking those soon. Sorry, we didn't anticipate the demand on that one. What else? Lena Dunham's New Yorker interview.
I have been thinking about this New Yorker profile of Lena Dunham for the last 24 hours.
So much ground was covered. She was interviewed by Rachel Syme. You and I, we've made no secret of our love for Lena Dunham. So this was such a wonderful bit of media to wake up to.
Also because she's not promoting anything in particular. The show that is going to star Meg Statler and Will Sharp, that's a fictionalized version of her moving to London and marrying her husband, isn't quite out yet.
No, she's promoting that film that she is acting in that she did not write or direct.
Oh, shit.
That's why this exists. There's just so much information in this piece that like it's hard to remember everything.
That's true, because it more feels like a girl's retrospective or like a 7 years after the fact exit interview for the show Girls, where she does finally admit like, yeah, Hannah's dumb. She's not a good writer, guys. I don't know why everyone didn't get that when I said that I was a voice of a generation as Hannah. That was a joke.
Poor girl. People just don't understand satire, you know?
I mean, to be fair, in the moment, I don't know if I got that either. But it is, as we've been on record in saying, Girls is a perfect document for the millennial, then called hipster, generation.
She also disclosed that the Polly Pocket movie is not happening, breaking my heart. We had really hoped that after the success of Barbie, that would just be immediately greenlit.
And it doesn't seem like it wasn't. It seems like what she learned out of the Barbie experience was that unless you can do the film as yourself in the way that she likens it to Nancy Meyers, that's she talks about how someone said a Nancy Meyers film, Nancy Meyers would be doing her Nancy Meyers thing with or without a studio. Right. And her point was that Greta Gerwig was able to show her own point of view while doing this massive IP thing. And it seems like after seeing that, she was like, I think I'm just going to keep doing my indie thing.
So the powers that be are not letting her do that.
I don't know. I think she just sort of looked at it and was like, I don't think I'm the one to do this. And I think that's a great lesson to learn.
She is the one to do it, though. How many writer-directors have parents with a prolific body of work that is about dollhouses?
You're very upset. So this is what she says. And I think Greta managed this incredible feat with Barbie, which was to make this thing that was literally candy to so many different kinds of people and was perfectly and divinely Greta. And I felt like unless I can do it that way, I'm not going to do it. I don't think I have it in me. I feel like the next movie I make needs to feel like a movie that I absolutely have to make. No one but me could make it, and I did think other people could make Polly Pocket. Also, I think it's very fair that she's like, I'm not for everyone, which she is correct about.
Yeah, but she also alludes a couple times in this interview to the fact that she is increasingly interested in making rom-coms and being the millennial Nora Ephron, Nancy Meyers, I suppose, which I think is a very good lane for her to be in.
Well, she also speaks to, she's giving herself a challenge every year to do something more commercial. Like she hints at some sort of MI6 CIA show that she's working on as well.
Whatever. I mean, we'll watch it, obviously. I'm very excited to read this book. She's writing another memoir.
I thought the most interesting thing about this profile is Lena Dunham's own reflection on time and slowing down her life and how she essentially lived decades worth of life in the span of 8 years with very turbulent highs and lows.
Yeah, it's giving the Obama administration. She aged like 20 years.
But she talks about this moment where it's like she was doing Girls. She went to an award show. She hosted SNL. She was maybe on the cover of Vogue. And then she gave a keynote speech at South by Southwest. And she's like, it's not that I wasn't grateful for all of those things, but she's basically saying, like, I couldn't appreciate each individual thing because each individual thing are things that people work their entire lives for that I got in my early 20s in the span of a month.
That's a lot for 1 month if you're also working on Girls and writing her book and all of that shit.
Well, yeah, she talks about how she's like, well, I wrote my first essay book in the span of 8 months in between scenes and writing Girls, and like I've spent the last 8 years writing the next one.
That's gonna be an interesting read.
Did you also like the fact that her favorite Taylor era is also Reputation, like yours?
I did. I'm glad Taylor was addressed in this interview. She basically said that she feels very protective of her, which I understand. Taylor Swift was my bestie.
I do like that she is still friends with, it seems, Taylor Swift post Jack Antonoff breakup, although I imagine they go to separate Taylor shows. I also thought it was interesting her explanation of not acting in this latest series and instead casting Meg Statler, which is a no-brainer. I mean, everyone loves her, but she talks about the fact of, like, I don't think I was up for having my body discussed again in the way that it was during Girls.
Which is completely understandable and completely fair. She's always received just such an extreme amount of vitriol for existing, but more specifically, I think, for not being so ashamed of her body that she felt the need to hide it. And I think that there's something about that that, like, triggered a lot of people, because it really flies in the face of, you know, how we're conditioned to be. And I think, like, watching Girls, to me, the nudity on that show always felt very political, but I think a lot of people received it more as, like, who does this bitch think she is?
I thought this was very interesting. She says, I used to think that winning meant you just keep going and doing it and you don't care what anyone thinks. I forgot that winning is actually just protecting yourself and doing what you need to do to keep making work.
Because I guess we literally just can't have one show where the naked girl just looks kind of normal.
Yes.
Like, really?
Very true. But I was happy to hear that it seems like in this new show, characters will actually be having good sex, because as we've noted about Girls, everyone had bad sex, which is brought up in this interview where Lena Dunham is trying to think, like, did anyone have good, passionate, like, sexy sex in Girls? And she's like, I don't think so.
Well, speaks to the age of the characters. Yeah, I really liked her disclosure that Hannah was a mediocre person. And I think that's something that we actually need to see more of in media, average people. I think that's why I like Mary Gateskill's writing so much, because she's not writing about exceptional people. She's writing about average people, if not people that are complete fucking failures in life.
I stand by the fact that I think if Lena Dunham didn't cast herself as Hannah, the discourse would have been different. Not just about body politics, but I think the message she was trying to send about this character and these group of friends would have been easier to understand.
Well, yeah, because if you're public facing, you always end up taking the shit. No one's coming for writer directors that are unseen in that way.
You know what? I take that back, because Lena in this New Yorker profile does talk about a recent interview that Allison Williams did actually with Eben Ross Baccarat. They did a Vanity Fair thing, and Allison Williams was making the point of, like, oh, everyone looked at our show and was like, oh, the girls in the show, they're just them. They're not acting. They're playing themselves. And somehow they looked at the men in the show, like Eben and Adam, and they were like, oh my God, they're geniuses. They're voices of their generation.
Yeah, that's so true. Which is not to say that Adam Driver's success is undeserved.
I love Adam Driver, and I'm still trying to figure out, like, how did that happen?
Excellent casting. Also, Rita Wilson returning in Lena Dunham's next project, Too Much, as Meg Stalter's mother. And Rhea Perlman is her grandmother. And Andrew Rannells and Lena Dunham play a married couple, which, that I can't wait to see.
I always love when creators create more things, but cast people they previously worked with, because then you know, like, oh, you guys actually get along.
The chemistry is undeniable.
Do you sometimes think about how Hannah now has a 7-year-old in the world of girls?
Okay, but that's what I actually can't wait for, is like the girls' reunion film.
It's going to happen with Max at some point.
It's going to be glorious. Let's just before sunset this shit and keep it going, you know?
Every 9 years, baby. So, Chelsea, you recently told me about a trailer that you've been getting waterboarded with called The Fabulous Four, which, if on the male side of, if men of a certain age, they're what are called geezer teasers, you know, where you see like Mel Gibson with a gun or Bruce Willis or John Malkovich. There's the female version of this, and it usually has Jane Fonda or Diane Keaton. And it's a bunch of friends getting together and hijinks ensue.
Yes, it's Book Club. It's Book Club 2. It's Palms. It's 80 for Brady. And now The Fabulous Four. Completely jarring that neither Diane Keaton or Jane Fonda are in this movie. It's almost like I didn't realize they could make one of these without them. But yes, the term hagsploitation exists and refers to horror movies with women of a certain age, but I think we need the buddy comedy version of that.
Yeah, what would that be?
Someone think of it and let us know, because there really needs to be a name for this.
So this film stars Bette Midler, Susan Sarandon, Cheryl Lee Ralph, and Megan Mullally, and we're supposed to believe that these women are all the same age?
I know. I was like, wait, Megan Mullally and Bette Midler? Because to me, that's like two different generations, but I looked it up and it's actually like not that crazy. Megan Mullally is 65 and Bette Midler is 78.
It is still a 13-year age difference, and they're all supposed to be college friends. So we should explain the plot of this film.
Oh, they're supposed to be college friends?
The log line says lifelong friends traveled to Key West, Florida to be bridesmaids in the wedding of their, oh, college girlfriend, rekindling their sisterhood amid drinks and romance.
Cheryl Lee Ralph is also younger. It's like Susan Sarandon and Bette Midler are of one age bracket, and yes, they are of another.
There's not much plot in the trailer from what I noticed. I know that someone stole someone else's husband at some point.
I think it's that Bette Midler's husband dies and then she immediately gets remarried because she's the Samantha of the group. All of these films that we've mentioned tend to follow Sex and the City like personality type tropes.
Right.
Because she's the Samantha, I guess she like immediately meets another guy and decides to get remarried.
I gotta say, the tagline's pretty good. Four friends, one wedding, lots of baggage. Look, Hollywood is obligated to make at least one of these films a year. And did you know that The Fabulous Four is coming out July 26th?
Oh, great. So soon. I can't wait for this shit. I love this shit. Thank God someone's cast Bette Midler in something. She should be in these movies. She should be getting to do comedic acting.
Sorry, I'm now checking Diane Keaton's IMDb because I'm like, why wasn't she in this? What's she doing?
But also I'm kind of like, what is wrong with this script? Because if Diane Keaton and Jane Fonda aren't in it, like what happened?
Sorry, she was busy in a film called Summer Camp that came out this year. It follows Nora, Ginny, and Mary, three childhood best friends who used to spend every summer at a sleepaway camp together. After years, when the opportunity to get back together for a summer camp reunion presents itself, they all seize it. And this one has Diane Keaton, Kathy Bates, and Alfre Woodard.
Okay, I like Kathy Bates entering into this. Also, is Wine Country one of these movies? Technically, they're younger, but thematically, I think it has a lot in common with Book Club.
That's right. Did you watch Wine Country?
Of course. You've never seen Wine Country? Babe, you would know if you'd seen Wine Country. That's literally crazy.
During a vacation in Napa Valley, a group of longtime friends reunite. Here's the thing.
Everyone has seen Wine Country that you're explaining this to. You're literally so crazy.
I think that this counts because it's a group of postmenopausal women getting together for a period of time. A weekend, a wedding, a bachelorette party, a summer camp reunion. I think that is what makes this genre.
You should see Wine Country. Like, it's not like Citizen Kane.
Wait, what?
But it's like very satisfying to just put on.
Okay, I'll add it to my list.
The weird thing about Wine Country, though, is that Tina Fey is like weirdly miscast as this extremely kind of butch character in the vein of like Melissa McCarthy's character from Bridesmaids, but less crazy. But it is like the weirdest vibe. Watch it and report back.
Will do. I think one of the greatest casting ideas, not just Melissa McCarthy and Bridesmaids, but her actor's secret that she was just going to embody Guy Fieri as this character.
She's the best. She's the best.
Moving on. We both watched the Dion von Furstenberg documentary.
Is it Diane or Dion? It's both is the answer.
Look, if her friends say Dion, her friends including Seth Meyers.
Yeah, that's the truly shocking thing about this film is that sort of at the 11th hour, Seth Meyers just randomly pops up.
I always find those kind of talking heads so sad because you know that they gave commentary for the entirety of Diane's life, but they were like, we're just going to pop you in here at the end.
I don't even know where to start. I think this documentary is the best thing in the world. I just watched it and I already want to watch it again because there's so much to digest. It is very compelling because it is both dishy and extremely inspirational and heartwarming.
And there are certain things she clearly doesn't want to talk about, and so she doesn't.
Like what?
If she's indeed married to a gay gentleman?
I think they addressed that head on. They didn't straight up say, like, yes, Barry has had relationships with men, or blah, blah, blah. They cut to Fran Lebowitz, who said, the world is now immensely accommodating to every kind of relationship. And then when the documentarians said to both of them, you know, Andy Warhol said, you know, I guess the reason they got married is because she gives him straightness and he gives her powerfulness. Diane's response is like, I think it's the other way around, which is something else we need to talk about, which is the fact that she is clearly a queer woman, and did she fuck Fran Lebowitz?
Oh. What I've gotten from this documentary is everyone's bi. Her first husband's a bi icon. She's a bi icon.
Yes, I just don't think they necessarily need to use those words.
Of course not, and they don't.
They don't, but I don't think that they're skirting around it. They were much more forthcoming about it than I expected.
I will agree with that. But there's a lot of interesting language that they use, especially around her first husband, Egon, who they keep describing as a decadent man, which I'm like, what an elegant way to say he was a philanderer.
They were swingers. They were fucking everyone. I'm sure together and separately.
Should we get into the early part of her life? Because as she even says, she's like, before I knew it, I had a brand. And you're just sort of off to the races in the documentary.
Yeah, she was basically like, I was born. I went to boarding school. I fell in love with a woman, got kicked out of boarding school. Then I met Egon when I was 18 and got married, and he was a prince, and then I was just living that jet set life.
And I put some pieces of clothing together, and, you know, next thing I knew, I was in Diana Vreeland's office, and before I knew it, I had a brand. It's like, oh, okay.
Also, I was just shocked that no one had figured out the wrap dress before her, just because, as she notes, she was inspired by the tops that ballerinas wear. The fact that no bitch had thought to be like, let's just add a skirt to that is crazy to me, because now there is a dress version of every kind of shirt that has ever been made.
I think there's nothing campier than the director behind the camera asking how she came up with the wrap dress, and Diane von Furstenberg goes, well, Nixon was in trouble. And you're like, what?
Her life is just so astounding and so inspirational. It's not even like her career that is the most impressive thing about her. It's just her whole personality, her candor, her wit, and how open she is in talking about her life, more so than I would expect. She's like completely unpretentious.
She's unpretentious and she is authentically who she is. You definitely get that in the documentary, but I love how they sort of like spin her being a feminism in the 70s. They're like, well, you know, Dion's feminism was being hot and like destroying the patriarchy from the inside.
She didn't not do that. Also, can we talk about her insane technique for applying makeup?
Which is, you mean hopping in her sink?
She literally, like, this film starts and she is crawled into her sink, so that her face is like
inches.
Yes, like 3 inches away from the mirror, and you just see her applying her eye makeup. It is like the most insane thing I've ever seen in my life.
Clearly her children, and I'm sure grandchildren, have told her that magnifying mirrors exist, and she's like, don't care. This is how I did it in the 60s. This is how I did it in the 70s, the 80s. That's how I'm always going to do it.
It feels like Miranda July behavior or something. It's like, I'm going to test the limits of what applying makeup can be like.
If this were Miranda July, she would start applying her makeup on the mirror.
Miranda July probably is watching this and is like, I'm going to start doing that from now on.
I love this documentary. There is a section in the 70s where it's like, Dion is a feminist. But I don't like the regressive discussion about like, well, when women were wearing suits, Dion was making dresses. It's like, okay, they both coexisted at the same time. It's fine. I think she designed the wrap dress. It looked good. It sold well. I don't think this was her statement against women wearing more masculine suits in the 70s.
No, her and Fran are attached at the hip. She loves a tuxedo on a woman.
And I'm sure she was friends with Bianca Jagger at Studio 54. I just hate that in these kind of look back documentaries, they have to make everything a political statement.
That's true. Although her success was a political statement, even if that wasn't at the top of her mind when she made this wrap dress.
Oh, no, absolutely. Marc Jacobs calls her the first influencer. Thoughts?
Well, I think the jet set people in the 70s were influencers. You just digest that through magazines and newspapers.
Well, she also was the product. She created the product, but she also wore the product. And I, too, in watching this documentary, was like, maybe if I get a wrap dress, like, I'll look like a 1970s era Dion von Furstenberg.
See, I think you would look good in one. I don't have like a dramatic enough waist to hip ratio to make that like a good idea.
That's right. You do have your own feelings about the wrap dress.
Well, I just don't think they're universally flattering.
Which was the whole thing about them. Or that was at least the log line about them.
But I think that's a fabric thing. Because a lot of them are that, like, crepey fabric.
Doesn't look good on everyone.
It just doesn't have a lot of give, which is what left the door open for a brand like Ghani to make a wrap dress that is just sort of more flattering of different sizes and stuff.
Well, get ready, Ghani. The von Furstenberg granddaughter is here to take over yet again. I was trying to think of a documentary that I recently watched where I was like, wow, this is so watered down. And it was the Sylvester Stallone one on Netflix where it was like he was just too involved and he looked like too good of a guy. But also, he didn't talk about being married to Bridget Nielsen once. And it's clear because his wife hated Bridget Nielsen. And what I appreciate about this documentary, Dion von Furstenberg gives the director a list of men she had sex with. Yes, queen. Kiss and tell. This is what I want.
I know. She fucked Ryan O'Neal and Warren Beatty in the same weekend. So major.
But she did reject a threesome with Mick Jagger and David Bowie.
Worst call ever. They were so hot in the 70s. That's almost like unforgivable.
If I had access to a time machine, I wouldn't do all the things that everyone says. I would go back
and force.
No.
No, she doesn't care.
No, I would be like, hey guys, I know Dion. Like, I'd be waiting in
outside
the hallway.
Dion's hotel room.
I'd be like, I know Dion rejected you, but hello.
Hi.
I had no idea about what I'll call her Susan Sontag literary era, where she was with that very boring man who made her dress in, or she chose to dress in very boring clothing and got out of fashion and lived in Paris.
She's had so many lives. Also, that time she just moved to Bali.
That was cool.
Also, I loved seeing video footage of her office from the 80s, which was this insane pink carpeted office.
Not that I didn't know this before, but it was not Samantha Jones who gentrified the meatpacking district as we may have thought from Sex and the City. It was Dion von Furstenberg.
She did that. I had no idea that her mother had been in a concentration camp a mere 18 months before she was born. And the doctors were like, you actually shouldn't have kids. Like, you'll probably die. Your body's been through too much. And she did. And that was Dion von Furstenberg. Which is as close to a miracle as I've ever witnessed.
She's the girl who lived. The other tragic thing is how her first husband, Egon, died of AIDS.
Well, that also. But fuck, this woman is resilient.
I guess I didn't really realize is her QVC era in the 90s.
I didn't either. I completely missed that. I always associated QVC with Joan Rivers and stuff. I think her brand had bounced back by the time that I became aware of it, which I guess would have been the mid-90s.
That's what I was going to say, is I feel like my consciousness came back in the late 90s when her son's wife at the time convinced her to reinvigorate the brand. Remember a few years ago, Jennifer Lawrence was in that movie Joy about the woman that created like the magic mop, and she had a whole...
I watched it. It was terrible.
Yeah, it's bad. I watched it on the plane. But like, I need that type of film about Diane von Furstenberg's QVC years.
Absolutely. And then her man just buys QVC.
Even better, she convinces Barry Diller of like, I get it. You've created the Fox network. But like, I think you should leave that and buy this thing called home shopping on cable. And he does.
This film is on Hulu. Watch it. It is fascinating. It is inspirational. It is extremely glamorous. And Oprah is in it.
And if you can believe it, there's even more anecdotes that we haven't referenced because she's that interesting.
She's too interesting.
So, Chelsea, also on Hulu, did you start watching Becoming Karl Lagerfeld?
I did.
With Daniel Brühl as a 70s era Karl Lagerfeld. Now, did you, like me, accidentally watch the English dub or did you watch the show in French?
No, I watched it in French. You watched it dubbed?
I accidentally watched the first episode dubbed because they offer you two choices, or at least they offered me two choices. But also, I didn't think anything was awry because all of the ads for Becoming Karl Lagerfeld are the English dubs. So I was unaware that the show is actually spoken in French.
Wow. You need to watch it in French.
No, I watched the second episode
okay,
in French.
Okay, good, good, good. Yeah, guys, like when you're searching for it on Hulu, make sure you're not selecting the dubbed version. Because I saw both options and clicked accordingly.
Here's the crazy thing. Daniel Brühl speaks German, he speaks French, and he speaks English. He's not the one doing the English dub of himself. That's the craziest thing.
Wow, that is weird. I'm only two episodes in, but I fuck with this show. Much less depressing than The New Look.
It feels like it could have been a season of Feud in the amount of, like, bitchy gayness between 70s era Karl Lagerfeld and Yves Saint Laurent. But, like, I'm glad it's not a Ryan Murphy show.
Yeah, it's based on the Lagerfeld biography Kaiser Karl, which I did not read. But it is set in the same period as The Beautiful Fall, which I did read, and that's a book that I think people have been talking about adapting for ages. I wondered what happened with that and why it ended up being this instead.
I mean, probably it's too much to put into a show, or someone owns the rights, didn't want to give it up. I don't know.
I feel like Ryan Murphy could still do it as Feud because this is in French and a lot of people won't watch it for that reason.
But guys, there's an English dub. I just told you.
It's not the same.
I'm just so intrigued that Daniel Brühl chose to be Karl Lagerfeld. It's brilliant casting just because he's a polyglot and I don't know any other actor who could speak German and French and bears a resemblance a little bit to Karl Lagerfeld in the 70s.
Okay, but the Yves Saint Laurent is really bizarre because from some angles he looks exactly like him and from other angles it's like, what the fuck is this?
Also, the most yoked Yves Saint Laurent ever. He's shirtless in the second episode and I'm like, if there's something called like iPhone face, I feel like actors of today are too ripped to be in many period films and shows that they're in.
Yeah.
I'm like, people didn't have bodies like this in the 70s.
No. Definitely not Yves Saint Laurent. I just love escaping to this world. I love that all of the minor characters are iconic figures in fashion.
I just love their day. It's like, have a coffee, meet a French Vogue journalist, get in your Rolls Royce, go to the atelier, go to a meeting about, you know, the Justice League of haute couture and ready-to-wear designers. Go to a cafe.
Go to the nightclub. It sounds great. Also, I just want to be hanging out at Yves Saint Laurent's apartment with that crew. That seems so fun.
We both have only watched the first two episodes. I guess our eyes into this world is this young socialite, aspiring fashion student, or really just a fashion stan who's obsessed with Karl Lagerfeld and Yves Saint Laurent. And because Karl Lagerfeld won't sleep with this guy, he decides to sleep with Yves Saint Laurent instead. That's basically where I've come to at the end of this first two episodes.
Yeah, he stole his boyfriend.
Well, but that's the thing, is Karl doesn't want to be his boyfriend or even have sex with him. Interesting they portray Karl Lagerfeld as sort of an asexual person.
Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's why he bought like every copy of The Beautiful Fall in Paris when it came out.
Right.
But you really root for Karl. The Marlena Dietrich Paris Vogue episode like traumatized me on his behalf.
This is true. The second episode, I imagine if it's based on a book, this is a real incident that happened, that the legendary actress Marlena Dietrich wanted to be dressed by Karl Lagerfeld. He spins it into a French Vogue cover story. She gets to the photo shoot and is horrified by what she calls a very garish outfit, a very garish pantsuit that Karl Lagerfeld designed for her, and she leaves.
Traumatic. Also, I've seen that issue of Paris Vogue, and it's so major because the cover is just black. There's no image on the cover at all. Just like gold embossed lettering.
Because she walks out of the photo shoot, Lagerfeld's assistant is there, and I kept expecting them to turn to her and be like, okay, you put the outfit on now. But he's just like, nope, we got no backups. I guess we're not doing this.
Yeah, I love that episode. And the fact that they devoted an entire episode to this situation is amazing. I cannot wait to see what the rest of what the show has in store for us.
Yeah, I can't wait to see, like, where does this end? Do we go up to the 80s? Do we get into, like, bodybuilder Karl era?
Yeah, Karl in his, like, insane Memphis apartment. I don't think they go that far. I think this is just 70s.
I know. It would be very funny if the end was just a flash forward to skinny Karl in the early 2000s with, like, a Diet Coke.
God, that man has lived a life.
Has his estate finally been settled? I feel like every 18 months we ask this question.
I don't know, but I'm going to go get another Diet Coke in honor of Karl's memory.
Okay, while you were getting a Diet Coke, I looked it up, and Karl Lagerfeld's estate is still not settled 5 years on.
I thought that Choupette was just getting everything.
Well, I guess there's tax and inheritance issues. See, that's the Ryan Murphy series, Feud, Estate of Lagerfeld.
Anyway, moving on to another...
larger-than-life designer?
Yes, yes.
Marc Jacobs presented his fall 2024 ready-to-wear collection. Do you want to talk about that, or do you want to talk about the Talon nails?
I guess the show first and then the nails,
sure.
I suppose. I love the show so much, and I continue to think that Marc Jacobs' evolution as a designer is fascinating because... he has completely abandoned the idea of making, like, wearable clothes.
Right.
Which used to be his thing. Now he just does whatever the fuck he wants, which is why he's making women look like twisted little mid-century dollies.
This seems to have more of, like, a Marilyn Monroe. I read he was inspired by the 7-year itch. But also, like, what if that dress was more sculptural?
Well, yeah, the first look is basically just this very stiff, cartoonish version of the famous Travilla dress, but it's structured so it looks like a gust of wind is coming from underneath it, but there's no gust of wind. And many of the skirts in this show are kind of flipped up in the front or the back in the way that a skirt would be if it was windy.
Yeah, these clothes are not exactly wearable. I don't think they're meant for the store. But I will say that these shoes, these like larger than life sandals that make your feet look super tiny, I would buy.
Well, see, that's what I don't get, because it's like, where the fuck do you buy that stuff? The clothes from the Marc Jacobs runway show, I believe, is only available at Bergdorf's and maybe a couple things through Marc Jacobs directly. But I just looked on the website of the stuff from the last collection. None of those shoes from last season, which were so amazing and looked like something that like a high fashion, like Olive Oil from Popeye would wear.
The other crazy thing, because you and I are both real heads, is what is expensive on the real and what is what I would say undervalued. OG Marc Jacobs stuff, very undervalued on the real.
Yeah, I agree. And I just bought the most insane Marc Jacobs dress from the real pretty recently. That was from, it wasn't like super old, it was from 2018, but Mark is the best. He's been the best. And it's interesting to me that I think increasingly, like, his shows are very much like fanfic for certain time periods and certain movies and certain other fashion designers. Like, he's very Quentin Tarantino-esque in that respect. But I kind of relate to that because I think when you are a fan of something, when you're like truly obsessed with something, there is this sort of level of frenzy around it. And you can tell through these clothes that he's so in love with clothes and history.
He's designed such commercial wearable clothing that I feel like in this, what did John Corbett say? The last quarter of the football game. That I think him designing for himself and himself alone and making these almost art objects is deserved. And I think he's doing some of his most interesting work.
Well, he's following the Comme des Garçons model in that respect. The runway pieces on the shows, it's like no one actually really wears those. They're just displayed in Dover Street Market. But they're selling a lot of other stuff. And in Marc Jacobs' case, he's selling the bags. He's selling fragrances. Marc Jacobs, Heaven by Marc Jacobs has been quite successful for them. So his company has kind of bifurcated into all of these different things. And this is more like the symbolic high fashion thing that just kind of keeps the ship going or keeps him relevant, at least in the fashion world.
Yeah, because he's having no trouble staying relevant with his TikTok presence and Instagram presence.
Oh my God. I've been wanting to talk about his obsession with his nails for a while because it is completely spiraled out of control. But that said, I love it.
And I also think it speaks to the last two collections, the Dolly collections, because those collections were so extreme. His nails are so extreme. I feel like it really speaks to the times that we're in. I do love that fuckettes have been DMing us for the last 2 months being like, have you seen the nails? What do you think of the nails?
Well, we thought it would just be the nails that he had done for the Met Gala. So I guess we should explain. These are very long, square, acrylic nails with gemstones affixed to them. And not just jewels, as you would normally see on someone's nails. Like, gems with settings glued onto his nails.
His nails look so heavy that you would imagine his hands are weighted down by them. And yes, the first time he debuted these nails was for the Met Gala in early May, and he has not stopped.
No, and he changes them. Like, they all have different concepts and color palettes, although they all involve this same long shape and these giant jewels.
You know what he looks like? He looks like a bedazzled Edward Scissorhand because he's obsessed with clacking the nails together and making sounds and presenting things in his refrigerator. Honestly, it's a miracle he completed this collection because it seems like he's so taken with his nails. As, by the way, we would be if we had those nails.
Well, also, it's like he's had to figure out how to do everything with those nails. So it's like he still needs to sketch. So his pencil, he posted a video of this. Someone built like basically like a puffy sleeve for his pencil so he can actually like grip it. But like he's had to teach himself how to write again, basically. I would say they're 3 inches at least, maybe even more.
Oh my God, no. Four? I mean like half a foot. They're so long.
No, it is fully crazy. Okay, also, he's gotten some backlash to the nails because many people have pointed out that this is a form of cultural appropriation. So he posted a video addressing this, but I think it's the campiest thing I've ever seen in my life. Let's just play a clip of it here.
Oh, hey, Mark. What's on your mind? Are those new nails?
Yes, Nick. They are new nails. And I want to show some respect and love, appreciation, and admiration, give flowers to the black women who in the 70s and 80s used their nails to express their creativity.
But it does feel genuine, and the comments section is really funny. My favorite being much loved sister Laquisha Marc Jacobs.
Oh God. Look, it's clearly a phase for him. Although, I don't know. I mean, he did do a hard pivot, what, 15 years ago and was like, I'm not a nerd anymore. I'm now this Marc Jacobs, which has lasted many years. But I was scrolling through his Instagram and it's like previous to those nails at the Met, it seems like he went through a long phase of having chrome nails that he would show off in selfies with the latest book he was reading.
Yeah, that was a phase that he had. And now it's the long nails and also vaping. Like, he's obsessed with vaping now. I assume because he has a young husband.
Yeah, it happens to us all, doesn't it, Chelsea?
Not me. I am not vaping. I'm not touching that shit. Hell no.
I do like any famous person showing off their fridge and how they organize it. And his fridge, as I suspected, is 3/4 beverages.
Well, he also posted a video and his assistant who does these videos for him is like, so Mark, basically, how do you take a shit? Like, how does that work? And he basically just shows off his Toto toilet and is like, I don't even like touch myself, which you have one of those toilets. Do you not follow up?
For those that don't have a Toto.
Yeah, I think that's 99.9% of people.
I just want to say the home that I was in had a Toto. We did not buy a Toto. We did for this new house because once you have a Toto, you can't go back. But here's what happens. You elect for water to be shot up your butt and then there's a dryer function. But like he would have to be on that dryer for 25 minutes for it to dry him completely.
I'm imagining him like getting his gel manicure dry while also using his Toto.
Oh, God.
I love that he has found this passion. I think it's delightful. And I think it's so fun that he has this little creative project that isn't necessarily like tied to anything like commercial with his business. It's just sort of his own form of expression, and that he takes it as seriously as he does designing his collections. Because basically in one of these videos, he shows you his setup. He's the one that's like configuring these jewels. He said like, this is inspired by the Art Deco jewelry of Jean Dupré. Like he has references, he has mood boards, he's sourcing materials. Like it's crazy.
He's put the work in.
He has put the work in.
Does he understand the history? Maybe not, but I'm happy for him.
I think he understands the history.
He's just like, why can't I do it too?
Yeah.
That is all we have to say about the things that have happened this week. And frankly, I'm itching to go on the Real Reel so I can search Mark Jacobs now.
Let's do it. Also, I just think we should note this is a big weekend for Lauren. She's getting married this weekend.
I am, unless Paul is going to go full method and like Mr. Big, leave me at the altar.
We'll see about that.
I haven't really talked about the wedding on the podcast because I accidentally read a bad podcast review that was like, okay, Lauren, enough shoving your wedding down our throats.
Well, actually, they called you a less interesting Star Jones, which was really rude, but I did appreciate the reference.
Here's the thing. Even our haters, we can't hate them that much because I was like, respect for that reference. That's a deep cut, and I get it.
But that's why it hurt all the more.
It actually delighted me. I thought it was funny because when I read that review, it's like, you didn't even know that much about the wedding. So I was like, how much have I been talking about this if you don't even know what was going on at the time?
Too much for that fuckette, clearly. One thing, though, that I really like about a lot of our bad reviews is that we get a high rating. It's like they're not giving us one stars. So it's like if you clicked on 4 and 5 star reviews, half of them could be like, fuck these bitches. 5 stars. They usually just think one of us is annoying.
Yeah, from what I've read, we're in a phase where they think that annoying person is me, not you.
Look, they've come for me in the past.
If I've noticed anything, it's a phase. It's like it's me, then it's you. Then it's because we talk about the Kardashians, then it's you, then it's me.
Well, look, we both can't be super fucking annoying at the same time. I'm glad we're switching off a little bit.
All right, guys, until next week where we may or may not be talking about my wedding. Who's to know?
We'll see.
All right, guys, until next week. Did I get left at the altar? Did I smash it with my bouquet? Tune in next week.
Look, if she does, guys, I promise to film it.
All right, guys. Bye.
Bye.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and Yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling Yuzu Mango IQ Mix Hydration Mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.